I'm Peggy Poole. I was in Sussex County, Virginia in 1965.
Jack Finley started out. Jim Bevel asked me to come to Chicago to do a slideshow to take
just
out.
Like one or two sentences.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right. SCLC staff Operation Breadbasket from 1966 to 1971. You're up.
Do you want to introduce?
You have to forgive me. I'm just an old man. Just come in. My son got me here. Okay. My name's Jim Brown. I'm with the Legal Defense Fund. I work for A. Philip Randolph and the Jewish Defense Fund out of Los Angeles. I'm the one that carried the money in most of the South. I was the money carrier. My daughter is Jackie Brown. We did the movies Rosa Parks, Boys in the Hood. We did Boycott and the story on A. Philip Randolph, 10,000 Men, 2,000 Men Called George. That's my son, Philip Brown, the son.
Oh, it was taken for.
He played a little football too, huh?
No, that was another Brown.
I'm
89. I'm much older than you.
That's right. I'm 81.
But where?
I'm 81. I hope I live that long.
Okay.
But you know, I was in it. I don't know if you know the role of the E. Philip Randolph played, but that's where the money came from.
Yeah.
It came from the Jewish Federation of Los Angeles.
Okay.
And the union, UAW. That's. I think we got some pictures out there of our team that my son had up there of A. Philip Randolph, Thurgood Marshall, and John Lewis.
Thank you. Yeah. I'm Barbara Foster. I was Barbara Custer when I went in 1965. I worked in Albany, Georgia. And our claim to fame was we were with two Roman Catholic nuns and several of the students from St. Mary of the Woods Catholic College. I'm from Indiana State. There was another student from Indiana State.
And I'm her husband, Joe, and we live in Indiana.
I'm Marie Guillory. I'm a spouse.
My name is Joe Cooney, and we were in Taliaferro County in 65 and 66.
I'm Mike Brown. I was in Henry County, Southern Alabama, in 65.
John Wolf. I was in Greenville, Alabama, Butler County, 65.
Leverett Millen. I was in Fairfield County in South Carolina.
Claire Kastner. I was in Choctaw County, Alabama, with a group from Providence, Rhode Island.
Okay, what are we supposed to talk
about? Well, one of the things that we haven't been doing, please speak your name before you talk, even if you're responding to somebody else, because we were at the table over there. There's a lot of conversation going on. Unless you pick up early on when you're listening to it, who's speaking?
Good.
So this is Peggy Poole. So we are supposed to be talking about challenges and successes in SCLC and SCOPE.
I'm Barb Foster. I got the impression we were supposed to talk about the impact of SCOPE and how it translates into our activities and experiences since. That's the impression I got from what Joe just said.
She changed it.
Okay.
That's fine.
Barb Foster, I really would like to hear people's comments about this, because I feel so many times when I do something and I go on, I have no idea how it impacted another person. And it's helpful to me to hear another perspective, because I have no idea. And the some of the presentation that Joe did was helpful.
This is Claire Kastner. I'll say that for me, probably the, I would say, most significant impact on me was a sort of change of vision of myself and the world. I think it was, I would like to think that our activities accomplished a significant number of new voters, and I know while we were there it certainly did, but I think Joe's presentation was helpful to indicate that in fact over the years the changes in the voting rolls really has made a significant difference in terms of the color of the elected officials in the South. However, I think that may or may not have happened whether or not I was there. But for me, it did put me in a position to have and continue to have a different perspective on the world. And I would like to think that I have led my life reflecting that, both directly, but primarily indirectly in terms of my understanding of the world.
I'm Mike Brown. I think lots of these struggles, the peace movement, union movements, civil rights movements, the feminist movement, these are all in many ways, I see them interconnected. And mm-hmm. I came here for this weekend because I really was anxious to hear how people have moved on. You know, I think it could be easy to live in the past and to live in 1965, but I, you know, and in line with that, I just want to talk about a couple of things that I've been engaged with, although they aren't always strictly in the civil rights movement issue. My wife and I worked in a Black Panther clinic in Chicago back in the late 60s, and it was around the time when there was the massacre of the five Black Panthers in Chicago, and that was a very good experience. You know, we were able to provide medical presence where there was a real need on the west side of Chicago. You know, some of the other things I've sort of been involved with most recently is trying to get a single-payer healthcare system in our country. You know, so I'm a member of Physicians for a National Health Program. We're not all physicians, but you know, that's really important. I mean, Obamacare, for example, I'm afraid ultimately is not going to work because it's going to be too expensive. But, you know, hopefully we will get to a point where we have some form of Medicare for all. And in the intermediate years, too, I was involved in some union organizing in hospitals, you know, trying to form unions. So that's sort of the kind of thing I was curious about people. How that activism has continued to affect them.
Where are you located now?
Now I live in Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
my name's Joe Cooney. I worked in Talbot County, Crawfordville. What I did when I went, I was affected too, very much so. And I'm a lawyer. I went back, finished law school, and went back, and I was co-founded a law office for the poor. And to do that, I actually worked full-time for the federal government and worked part-time, and my money went to hire an attorney and a secretary. We started out, and we represented the poor and originally, and believe it or not, in the mental hospital on our civil cases, and we branched off to a lot of other things, all civil cases, and we ultimately filed, we had the first jury trial in housing discrimination in D.C., but we had other federal cases, and actually filed, if you can believe me, two school desegregation cases in Louisiana against parochial schools. But the law office is still going. We still serve the poor in Washington, D.C., and some middle class. And there's, now there's 11 attorneys, and we have a staff of 50, and we're very much involved in the right now with the housing problems. My wife is, but she's been, over the years, we were also active in promoting or active in the Democratic Party. But I think that that, my experiences with the folks in Crawfordville, they were very strong, and I think it actually, I guess, the easiest way I can explain it is it allowed me to continue working for the poor and people who had problems when other people could were burned out. So many times we get people involved and they just, it's impossible, and they just fall away because they think it's impossible to change things and affect things. But that's, I guess, my sense of endurance, I think, I picked up in Crawfordville. I don't know if that makes any sense, but so I don't know if I identify myself. My name is Joe Cooney, for the whoever's transcribing this.
My name is Leverett Millen, and I worked in Fairfield County in South Carolina. I just wanted to follow up what Joe talked about, the sense of endurance, and I'm proud to say that 50 years later, I am the co-sponsor and founder of a peace club at an inner city high school in Albuquerque, New Mexico, the only one in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And it's very exciting to be doing this. And what I learned in Fairfield County was like a conjunction between my history as a Jewish person devoted to what we call tikkun olam, or repairing the world, and giving and making a difference, because my mother had 23 cousins and uncles and aunts that were killed in the Holocaust, and I wanted to do something to make a difference. I didn't want to be silent like my parents' generation, and that intersected with the teenagers that we met in Winnsboro, Fairfield County. The power of what they, you know, they would tell me what they learned from their parents about, you know, this is a hostile environment and we've got to be cautious. But they also learned from their, especially their mothers, about resilience and making a difference. And that was a lesson that it boosted my resilience spirit, and it also energized their resilient spirit. So it was a powerful experience for me.
Something.
Go ahead.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. I just
have to see your
thoughts. Your name. You have to say your name.
Your name again.
Big Ben.
Name.
Your name.
Say your name.
Jim Brown. I had a thought thinking about all of you, all the work that you've done. You know, I only ran into you one time, and they called me to come to Albany, Georgia. And is having a problem a lot with the rest of your company. I didn't make it to Macon when it was called, but the work that all of you have done, you know, that I know that what you were out there. I mean, I was with the Defense Fund, but I know everywhere you've gone, what you were doing. This is a tremendous history to you. Something I was thinking about. You know, you know about the Boynton House in Selma. Mm-hmm. Okay. We have purchased the Boynton House. And what we're going to do with it, they're like LaRusso was killed. The people was killed. You know, Reverend Reese was killed. We're setting up a room and a park for them in the house. It's going to be a museum. I was sitting there thinking, Jose does not have anything. The idea I like to take it with my people, my son is here, and raise the money and do a ongoing room for Jose. Because that's, you know, I was with Jose when they were in, before they did the march on Washington, the march on Selma Bridge. And Jose played a tremendous part there. There was a problem there at that particular time between SNCC and SCLC, but we brought it together. And I think some of the things that Jose did at that particular time, between Andy Young, to get the people to march, I think he deserves something to be recognized in that house. And it's something else, I think it's just something, he has nothing. And Jose was very instrumental in everything. I met Jose, he came out to LA, I met Jose, and we got, that's when we made Miss Boynton a Delta in Los Angeles. And through them, dealing with Goldman and Efren from the Jewish Defense Fund, who gave us the money, in fact, they gave us about $100,000 that went to Thurgood Marshall. That's what went to everybody. But Jose was one of those that was instrumental in putting this together. And I just think he deserves something in that house. I really do. And I was talking with my son, I talked with John Reynolds, you know, and I told him I was going to come. And I would even like to put together, film something. That we did Rosa Parks. Jackie Brown's my daughter. We did Waiting for Sale, Boys in the Hood. We did a lot of movies. But I think you deserve something very similar. Have you seen the documentary we did on, did my son have some out there?
I haven't seen it, I haven't.
Well, he has a documentary. We filmed the young people who was there at the bridge. We filmed, everybody was there at that particular time. We filmed the beating of Bernard Lafayette, had Bernard been here. We filmed everybody, but the main person at that particular time was a young lady named Amelia Boynton. And we have her house. And I was just thinking about setting up a fund, working with you, setting up a fund, talking to people, and give a room in the house to Amelia Boynton like we're doing some of the other people. I think Jose deserved it. Because Jose had done something. I was with Jose doing the boycott. I mean, we filmed that. Rosa Parks, we filmed that. But Jose has not got any credit for anything that he had done. And that's my son. That's Jackie Brown's brother, and that's my son there. But I think it'd be
better now that my dad is.
I think it'd be very important, you know, that I let him talk. He can kind of.
The title of the DVD that my dad put together is called "Passing the Torch to America's Youth," and I've been blessed that my dad's passing the torch to me. That I can then pass it on to my children, generation. And that's part of what I was talking about earlier in the session, how you guys are, you know, part of that spark that really set so much ablaze in terms of political standpoint. And as Smiley said, you're not dead. We're not dead. And we can continue to set ablaze fires, especially now with the young people that they have an energy to do something. They weren't trained like you, and they need that in order to make the change that has to go forward. The economic change, the disparity in so many different areas, that has to happen. But they have to have your training. And what my dad was saying in terms of a room, and I spoke to some of you who bought the DVD. That along the same lines, to have a wall to honor your service. And that's something that I think would go along with the Hosea Williams room, so that, you know, and it's a plaque that, you know, you purchase for X. It helps to raise money for the home. But your children, your grandchildren, your great-grandchildren, here's a place that they can visit and see your mark on that history. So to hear my dad express it like he just did, I mean, that validates what I've been feeling since, you know, I've been sort of impregnated with the information that you guys have given me over this weekend, which is just so powerful. So.
Well, something else is, the young lady did this, the sculpture on Bobby Jordan in Texas. She had volunteered to do, we're going to do about everybody that was in the house. But it would be nice to talk to her and maybe do a full size of Jose Williams. I'm just angry about it. All that he have done should be more on Jose. And everybody don't really know about it. I kicked myself. I shouldn't have had a camera crew here and film some of this. I knew all that you have done, but the story needs to be out. And I do the best I can to get it out, but it should be out.
Thank you.
In fact, I should have been here a long time.
Is there anybody else that wants to talk about?
Sure, I'll talk.
Yeah.
I'm Jack Finley. I'm going to play devil's advocate a little bit today. I graduated from college last year. It took me 60 years to get it from start to finish. I'd rather talk about I'm 81 years old, and I'd like to talk more about what we can do in the future. I think it's great that we can remember the stuff we've done in the past and honor those people who have, you know, contributed to Dr. King's dream. But I want to say some of the stuff that's happened since. Jim Bevel had a workshop in Chicago back early or late winter, let's say, in 1965. And I was going to college for the third time. And when Selma March happened, I took a little college group. It was a chapter of the American Humanist Association. And basically, it was anybody who was sort of an outsider on the campus that didn't like what was going on in the world and ever like that. We're involved with us. We had about 35, 40 people. Well, we heard about Selma March, and our organization organized a march with two other colleges and marched in support of Selma. And that spread over, and we ended up involving the larger community. So basically, we got the liberal Democrats and everything involved. So we went and had a lacrosse equal rights group, whatever. And so they ended up contributing to SCLC. And so anyway, this in sometime in December or so of 65, we heard about this workshop that was going to go on in Chicago. So I went to Chicago, met Jim Bevel for the first time. And I fell in love with the man, the most dynamic person that I have ever known in terms of having a sense of humor and being able to get to the core of whatever he was talking about. Anyway, Jim talked me into coming to Chicago to put together a slide and tape show to organize college students in the Midwest to come to Chicago that summer for the 66 End the Slums campaign. And I don't know if that was really connected. A lot of the people from the South, the Southern staff came up there and worked on that, but it wasn't basically for voter registration. The Chicago machine pretty much had that, you know, tied up. But anyway, we worked in ending the slums. Chicago had a thing like most cities, I think, where they had redlining for every year, at least one street would be extended further where black people would be able to come in, get houses, pay a lot more money than they should, market rate. There was white flight and everything, so the people that had the houses and everything, they ran. So anyway, that's what we were working on. And then a lot of other stuff, too. That summer, we marched in Marquette Park and Gage Park. And I had the dubious honor of having the brick that hit Dr. King miss my head by about that far. I was out in the street with the other photographers. And basically, I was documenting what was going on. We needed it for legal reasons or anything like that. After that summer was up, Dr. King named Jesse Jackson as the national head of Operation Breadbasket. And I think that was really sort of the beginning of black capitalism. I stayed there for 6 years, and it took me that long to realize that I was burned out and that the goals that Jesse had were not the same kind of goals that other people had. In SCLC, and there was a power struggle. I remember very vividly coming out of a retreat at the Chicago Theological Seminary. I was coming out and Jesse was standing there, Reverend Jesse L. Jackson, and Dr. King came up and he said, "Jesse, I want you to know that I haven't spent the last 20 years of my life to go down in history as a person who championed black capitalism, if that is going to be as evil and as sick and as self-serving as the present white business run, including, you know, everything that was going on." So it took me, you know, 6 years before I decided that I couldn't do that anymore, especially with some of the stuff that happened in the inner warfare on the SCLC staff, you know, top management. So just about the time when Jesse got his walking papers from SCLC, he started Operation Push, I left. I was totally burned out, but I did spend another year with another little community organization, which was the original Rainbow Coalition. And it was in uptown Chicago. It was run by, I can't think. Anyway, two preachers from the South. They're Chuck Gary and Iberius Hacker. And they, with another lady, and I have, you know, memory loss, short-term, long-term. So, you know, anyway, it was a very... They had Native Americans, Latinos, blacks, Appalachian whites that come there, all people who were, had gone through their own sort of a depression in this neighborhood. And they organized. Well, Studs Terkel, you familiar with Studs? Studs was involved with that. He was one of the helpers on it. And I had spent all my whole life as a newspaper photographer and doing audiovisual stuff. So anyway, Studs wanted to do another book, but he wanted to do it on civil rights people, especially people from the religious, the churches that are involved in it. And so I took, rode in Chuck Gary's old Cadillac, it's like about a 10-year-old Cadillac, on a ride from there to his hometown, which is Horse Branch, Kentucky. And stayed for a weekend. Now, on that ride down there in his old Cadillac, I had a lavalier mic around his neck, and he started telling me his life story. And that was going to go into this book as one of the interviews. Well, I found out later that I was talking to a schizophrenic, and everything I got really wasn't that realistic. And I find that that's true in other places of the movement. We have people create their own fantasy, you know, to justify what it is they're doing. So anyway, after, you know, 6 years, I got out, went with this organization for a while, and then I just decided, well, you know, I need to make a living and everything. spent 6 months driving a cab in Chicago, yellow cab. Went to Jim Tillman, if you ever know him. He had an audiovisual production company. I worked with him for about a year. Ended up taking over media services department for the Chicago University of Chicago Press. And eventually, through a bunch of other stuff, I moved back to my hometown, went to college. And this is when my story gets a little bit disjointed here. So this is a year later, in 1966, I come to Chicago, Bevel brings me on. From that, I leads after that, the summer was over, to Operation Breadbasket. So basically, after that, Jesse continued on to become him and Al Sharpton as the you know, probably most popular black leaders, you know, in the country. I didn't talk to Jesse for 50 years, and about Christmas time last year, I get a telephone call from Gary Massoni, who was one of the four of us that started Operation Breadbasket. All of us basically were technicians. Jesse set the policy and whatever. I did the PR work, setting up press conferences and stuff like that. Probably made 1,000 picket signs when I get volunteers come in that we used on our marches. But anyway, so I ended up going back to work. I ended up starting my own business in Evanston, Illinois. It was a stat house, pre-production for about 60 different artists and people in the media. And then I ended up burning out, and I went to Hawaii, moved to Hawaii. I went to another newspaper. It was the fourth newspaper that I had worked on over the years, and became basically a beachcomber, $20 a month cottage and everything. So then my father died, and I came back. And this is getting kind of jumbled here, because this is what...
Do you mind if you can... I just like to make sure
everybody gets a chance.
Yeah.
I'll do it real fast.
No worries. It's fascinating. No worries.
Okay. So anyway, I'd rather deal not on the past, because I found at 81 years old that most of the time the things that go bad for you allow you to get out of a situation that you probably wouldn't move out of being aware of it. But there are opportunities to be made. 12 years ago, I started an organization, a chapter of Veterans for Peace. And I was president in my hometown, and I was president for like 4 years. And the major thing that we accomplished was we put together a teen war memorial. At that point, for the 407 18 and 19-year-olds who had been killed in action from 9/11 on. And we have this fake cemetery with crosses with a picture and a background, short bio on the person, where they were born, what city, their hometown, and everything like that, where they died and what the conditions were. Basically, as a exposure to high school kids so that they could realize what the true cost of war is, and especially when you're in an empire, it thrives on war. This country is 200 years of an empire that's been building and building and building. It's very astute. It plans great plans and everything. So that's where I've gone from that. I spent the last 3 years, and basically the reason we did that too is also is that the government, this empire that we live in here, has most of these parents of these kids who were killed in Afghanistan and Iraq have believed, because the government has told them, your kids died heroes, your American heroes. That's bullshit. They're victims of war, the wars that have continued, the 40 wars that have continued in the history of this country. Dr. King said that America doesn't have an economic problem or a political problem, it has a moral problem. And basically, reaching the mountaintop, he could see, I think, a little bit beyond what most other people would think, that if you reform the Democratic Party, you get involved in political, you're going to change everything, make it nice for people. That is plain bullshit. Has it happened? It's never going to happen. This country... Okay, one more minute. Okay. So I've been working, trying to get a thing off the ground called International Truth and Reconciliation. It happened in South Africa. It happened in Northern Ireland, a half a dozen other places. Significantly, it happened 7 years ago in Iceland, where they had the same sort of a takeover, the government and the tie-up with military-industrial complex. Ike spoiled this all out when he left office. So anyway, they had this truth and reconciliation thing in Iceland and sent a whole bunch of lawyers, politicians, and bankers to jail, rewrote their constitution, and now they have a socialist little country there. So anyway, I wanted to do the same thing, but I wanted to do it as an international scale, where the United States would be put on trial, have to answer charges for the last 200 years of activity. Israel would have to do this. Great Britain would have to do this. All of the countries of the world that nobody really knows the true history of. Maybe if you get to graduate school, you're going to get a doctorate in history, you'll learn about what's happened in this country. I think the American people have been so discouraged, just give me 1.5 minutes,
all right,
and everything, so misled by this smoke and mirrors program that's developed in the last 100 years, that people are going to have to be exposed to this. It has to be on a worldwide basis. I tried to get people like Ted Turner to put together an international satellite working to take this whole process as it goes on. If people are challenged, they have to come and answer their country, what they did, and have it on television all across the world, 24 hours a day if they wanted to. And Oliver Stone would organize the theatrics and everything involved in it.
Thank you. Thank you for that. There's no question.
So far,
you stayed politically involved. Would you like to say something now? Because there's some people that haven't.
Yeah, I'm Barb Foster. And as I said, I wasn't sure, as I work in different areas, that anything I've done has really made an impact. But what I was driven by was my faith. And I was very compelled to come and risk everything for the idea that we were Christian and we needed to stand up with those who were oppressed. And King's message was always resonated with me. And when I returned home, it was difficult because it's hard to find a place, because I was so out of sync with everything else that was happening. And as I've gone through my life experiences, I've tried to find a place where I could change small things or make an impression on someone. I work through the United Church of Christ, and we've done a lot of social justice issues, peace and justice issues. I was involved a lot in hunger work, Bread for the World, different places that you learn about the processes that are going on in advocacy work. The environment is important to me. One of the most extreme experiences, and I was led to these things. I didn't just decide I was going to do this, but I ran for Congress in one of the very, very conservative areas in Ohio, and the legislator died while he was in office, and I kept watching. I thought, oh, everybody should know this is a good opportunity. Why isn't anybody talking about these issues? You know, and I kept thinking, where is everybody? And I went to an event that was hosted by Bread for the World, and they kept telling us, you know, write to your legislator, do this, and this is the best way to handle certain issues and whatever. And I raised my hand and I said, well, our legislator just died. What do we do? We can't send a letter because there's no one to receive it and to vote. And they said, oh, just run for Congress. I'm like, yeah, right. I had 4 children under 10, and it was like not a good time. But I really felt that was something, as I said, I looked around and nobody was speaking to the issues that I felt needed to be expressed. And Joe is a pastor, and I kept thinking, we'll get run out of town on a rail, you know, if the people do not allow me to do this. First of all, Joe allowed me to go ahead and do it. This meant more difficulty and challenges at home. And it was an educational experience. There were 8 candidates. 6 were Republican, 2 of us were Democrat, and I was the only woman. And it was a time where you didn't have to spend a fortune, although you could. And I ended up losing, which I was thankful for. And I connect myself a lot like Pat Schroeder. She had a similar experience in Colorado. And from what she said later, she said, Barb, I won, and I had to go to D.C. and work. And so I was just very thankful I didn't have to at that time. But there are all kinds of things. The peace and justice became a very big thing, and the environment. We have 4 children, and they were deeply immersed in a lot of these issues. I took one of my children to the peace march in 81 at the UN, between the Central Park and the UN. There are things like that that I've continued, and the church encouraged participation in many of those things. And our lives have changed a great deal because we went from one community to another, and now we're retired and we're back in Indiana, which is a challenge in itself. So I have to look hard and try hard to find places now to make some kind of an impact.
I think the key word's advocacy. Mm-hmm. That's what you learned.
How about you?
I would relate to your
name, please.
Janet Wolf. Her experience with the being a lot of it being church related, but for me has happened since then, because I went straight from the SCOPE project to seminary, and the seminary was extremely active in all these 60s issues, and including they had a bunch of them had been at the Wilcox County, where Maria was, and so I had people in common that, and later one of the people that was with me with the seminary for a little while, anyway, we were continued involvement in civil rights, and I went to Oakland the next summer and worked on a project there, and we did some stuff with the farm workers in Delano. And then a very lot of protest on the Vietnam War, and a lot of the guys were resisting the draft and that kind of thing. So we had lots of that sort of activity. It was kind of a wild time to be in seminary. But one thing, you're talking about burning out, and you mentioned that too. What I began to see over the longer period, because I stayed out there for 24 years, I couldn't get a job, or at least I decided I couldn't. That was also the women's issue. There were less than 100 women in the Presbyterian Church when I went, and so there weren't role models, and it's up to the church to call their pastors, not appointed. So unlike the Methodists, where I think women move faster because they were appointed. But I began to see that we needed to grow. There needed to be a spirituality alongside the activism in order to keep from burning out. Now, it can be a lot of different things. I'm not going to put a lot of boundaries on what it is. I've especially learned this from my mentor, Howard Rice, who spent most of his adult life in a wheelchair, but did wonderful things. I think that we need that balance. And I've kept up with lots of the seminary people over the years, and the ones that were able to do that didn't burn out. The ones that were not able to do that usually did burn out. And the church can burn you out pretty fast, too. So... But I've been off and on active in different things. In the 80s, I wasn't terribly active, but I was in the nuclear freeze a little bit and in the protests against some of the stuff that was going on in Central America. And I was not a Reagan fan by any means. But, then when I was a pastor, I had a church that was very little church, but very divided politically. So I kind of had to walk a fine line trying to figure out how to deal with what was important without squashing the people I disagreed with and getting in lots of trouble. And I did talk about my experience in the SCO project and in the Selma March and things like that because I thought they should know about it. And I would do my King poster and my autographed book and all that on Martin Luther King Day. And so I kind of kept that up there. But I also, then when I retired, I felt more free to get involved in a more partisan way. But I still think we need to try to figure out how to be civil with the people we don't agree with. I've done some work with the Democratic Party and with worked on the gay marriage issue in 2006 in Wisconsin, and then that got thrown out with the Supreme Court decision. And of course, then there was the whole ongoing thing about women in ministry. But lately, I've been involved in climate change issues. And as Citizens Climate Lobby is supposed to work across party lines, so I've been trying to apply the things about that. Parker Palmer wrote a book called Healing the Heart of Democracy that talks about how to get the stories out of your opponents and how to work more in a more civil way, and I've been studying his stuff. So I think we really need to, I just know in March I made a video of my experiences in 65 for the local TV, and I've been taking that around and showing it. But I think that I said at that, it's really important that we don't forget our history, that we remember what we did, but that we not treat it like something that some of you have said that we need to not, well, it's all done now. We don't have to worry about that anymore, but we've got to continually keep on dealing with the issues because it's not settled yet with the police issue with Ferguson and Baltimore and everything, and with the, I think, a lot of dog whistle racism in connection with Obama and some of the things he does. And I mean by that hidden racism. There's plenty of issues around race still to be dealt with. That was strongly emphasized at the reunion I went to at the seminary on the same subject in April. And so the professor of Black Studies there really, really preached us a sermon on not forgetting about racial issues as we deal with gay and lesbian issues or women's issues or all the others that kind of came up at the same time. It's kind of an exciting time to live, though. So I do think we got to keep going forward. And this has kind of inspired me again on that.
My name is Peggy Poole, Peggy Ryan Poole. The summer, the SCOPE experience certainly changed my life. And when I came back, college seemed very irrelevant, and I dropped out. I was very involved in anti-Vietnam protests. I lived in Berkeley. And then just hitchhiked around a lot. Eventually coming back, and I landed, I was a social worker for a while, and then went into nursing. And I think one lesson that I took from the South and also from nursing is that you may not be able to change the big picture, but you can focus in on little things and change those, and that can improve quality of life. So I've been a nurse practitioner now for over 20 years, and so for my volunteer kind of part of my life. I work a lot. I've always worked with underserved populations and health care for the homeless, which is very rewarding for me personally. And certainly politically, I've stayed involved. So the summer was an incredibly powerful experience, and it's something I actually didn't talk about really at all until last year when I lived in Berkeley in the Bay Area and Bruce organized a reunion, and that was the first time. And that was the 50-year reunion for Freedom Summer, but all of us were invited. And I went in and I sat down next to this guy. I didn't know anybody. And I said, "Oh, where were you?" And he told me, "You know, I was with SNCC. I was in Mississippi, blah blah blah." And I said, "So when you got done, did you go back to school?" And he said, "Yeah, for about 2 weeks." And that was so liberating for me because I just thought it was me, and it wasn't just me. I've stayed politically active. I mean, the social consciousness was probably from my parents, and certainly being involved with SCOPE and SCLC just fed that. But there's also maybe a little bit of work to still look at in terms of the impact from the summer and the impact emotionally and psychologically on us. So anyway, that's what I have to say.
Where are you now?
And I'm in Berkeley.
Stayed in that summer.
I stayed in Berkeley. Yeah, so there's plenty of political involvement.
You're on my hero district.
I think perhaps, again, this is Peggy Poole, that you can appreciate being in medicine, that it's a privilege. When people allow you into their lives and allow you to help, it's a privilege. And being down south and working with people that had so little, almost nothing, and their generosity and their bravery, and their faith, although I don't share that faith, but their faith was very inspirational and continues to be inspirational in my life.
I'm Mike Brown. I remember talking to friends who are Cubans, who were a part of the revolution that took place in Cuba with Fidel Castro. And one of the things that has happened in Cuba is that a lot of the younger generation people who never were a part of that struggle, of that revolution, find themselves unable to understand why they have some of the problems that they have in their society. But they're not involved in any new struggles. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see what happens now that there's a rapprochement between Cuba and the United States. But the idea being, you know, that we have plenty of struggles right now, you know, for the generation that is now. I mean, maybe we're too tired to go to a meeting four times a week at our ages now, but, you know, there is 350. .org.
Yeah.
And I mean, there's so many. The environment, of course, is probably the single most vital issue facing civilization at this point. But there are plenty of other struggles, and, you know, local struggles in schools and with election campaigns and hell, trying to do something about what's going on in Congress. You know, so there can be, there's a lot of work to be done. Is there a movement starting now? I mean, there's some sense that there is a movement, right? There's some sense that something is beginning to gel in this country. I was a part of the Wall Street events that spread to Oakland and, you know, so many other places around the country.
Occupy.
You know, so there's really, that's part of, I think that's part of the movement that's starting now. There really is, I can talk to my conservative relatives and use the terms the 1% and the 99%, and they understand. You know, they know they're part of the 99%. They know that they're not part of the 1%. They may not know as much about it, you know, the 0.1%, for example, but we know that there's this diversity, you know, economic polarization that's going on in this country. So they have that fight to deal with. You know, how much can I do about it? Maybe something, but it's really going to be my children, and probably even more so my grandchildren, you know, who are going to have to fight that fight, you know, with the environment or, you know, the Tea Party or, you know, economic polarization that is occurring. So I think that what movement there is in this country right now is very disparate. I mean, it's on so many different levels. I mean, there's a movement around the health care issue. Well, it's been, you know, the Affordable Care Act is, you know, it's a blessing and a problem at the same time. So, because, you know, I mean, 11 or 12 million people now have health insurance that didn't, but there's still between 30 and 40 million people who don't have health care. And, you know, so the Affordable Care Act hasn't solved the real problem. And only a national health care program will. But, you know, there's a lot of fights. There are a lot of fights that people can be engaged in.
I think the movement, if I can just add a little something here, is going to be led by children, teenagers.
Yeah.
Right now, they're totally fascinated with selfies and finding people that they can communicate with on their cell phones.
Mm-hmm.
I have a picture that I took out of the side window of my house with my granddaughter, who is 23 years old. She's sitting in a lawn chair, smoking a joint with her telephone.
Mm-hmm.
When these kids get organized, it'll be the most fast-spreading revolution in the world. I think if they can be shown that there's a better way of creating education, distributing the wealth and everything, and it doesn't have to be Marxist-oriented, doesn't have to have a political thing on it. It's something new for people to decide how everything should be split up and who makes the decisions. It may make politics, traditional politics, you know, no longer necessary. I think, you know, my hero right now is the Pope. I went to 12 years of Catholic schools, and after I got out of that, it took me about 30 years to realize that all of that stuff that I had learned and everything just wasn't relevant to me anymore. But now, all of a sudden, here's this Pope that wants to make it a church for the poor. You know, he's still got a few hang-ups here, but man, it's going to split the Catholic Church, I think. You're going to have the wealthy, well-to-do, upper-middle-class Catholics, and you're going to have Tea Party Catholics, and you're going to have extremely right-wing Catholics that want to make things stay as they always have, including the Latin masses and everything. But he's going to, you know, he may be one of these popes that gets assassinated. Pope John.
I'm going to just
go.
Interrupt.
Just say your name.
Claire Kastner. One thing about what you were saying about the social media, I think one of the dangers of the social media is that it is sort of the antithesis of what you were talking about resilience and sticking with things. That social media, you know, a movement happens in 2 weeks and then it's done with and we've moved on to something else. But what I was going to say was, because we were sort of talking specifically about how we how we moved on. I was lucky enough to have just graduated from college when in 65. So, but I was also lucky enough that the Vista had just been established. So I went directly into Vista and worked in a job training program in Philadelphia with Reverend Sullivan, who had done one of his job training things. And then I continued doing that for about 10 years in that program. And then by then, the government had the war on poverty. So there were anti-poverty agencies. And it didn't feel to me, even though some people felt maybe as though already the government was co-opting our energies to work in it. Anti-poverty agency, and what I actually was proudest about the agency that I worked in Boston was that it really made an attempt to bring together each of the neighborhoods in Boston, each of whom was quite suspicious of the other. And this was an agency that, for all its weaknesses, its strength was that it actually brought together those people who were battling over busing in Boston, but this was a place to talk about it together. I don't think it was burnout. I think it was sort of assessing my own skills that I said, I don't think I've always been a sort of helper as opposed to the leader person of any of these projects. Anyway, so I didn't want to stay and become an administrator in one of these, this job training program. So I also went to nursing school. And it's interesting, I've sometimes felt guilty about that I kind of moved away from a more active sort of political action kind of life. But I do feel as though, and it's sort of what I was saying in the beginning, what all of this experience gave me was a sensibility about whatever I was doing in life, and in this case it was geriatric care for many years. And I do think that, and also, you know, again, some political activity, but always sort of a supporter rather than, I didn't found any groups to do one thing or another. But I think for all of us that underpinning of being aware of the, as you say, the families who were so willing to open up to, and yet it appeared that they had little, and yet it gave us a sense of sort of the power of each of us to be able to move forward and look at the world a little bit differently. Anyway.
Leverett Millen, and I think that what's exciting to me is recovering what I learned from my mother, who always said you have to be suspicious because the Cossacks are around the corner, but you also have to give back. And that lesson stayed with me, and it was there when I was in Fairfield County talking to the teenagers, and we had a freedom school where we talked about great books and their stories of how their mothers taught them, you know, the police are around the corner, but you have to make a difference. You have to stand up. And right now, what's exciting to me is that the movement is alive in Albuquerque. We have the Peace Club at the working class high school that I work at with, you know, it's got 8 people in there, but they, you know, the ROTC, which has about 600 people, is afraid that the Peace Club is going to destroy ROTC. Well, you know, well, no, but then on the other hand, I'm working with members of the labor movement on a single payer plan that works for a statewide plan that works for New Mexico, and it's so exciting to see these 60, 70-year-old people and 50-year-old people who are, you know, recovering the history of the labor movement, because if it wasn't for the labor movement, we wouldn't have Social Security or Medicare or Medicaid, and so there's lots of things happening. And the other piece of good news from New Mexico is that the right-wing Secretary of State, who was obsessed with voter suppression and people voting with a false name, you know, of course, there's like one out of a million that do that. She herself is now about to be impeached by the House of Representatives in New Mexico, because she has been gambling and using state funds to fund her gambling habit. So it couldn't have happened to a nicer person.
Fortuitous.
Right.
Intervention.
Right.
What about the police issue there?
It's very complicated, because they talk about stuff about the police and they don't have training to deal with mental health, but it's all the pardon expression bullshit, because in Albuquerque is located the largest number of weapons of mass destruction in one place in the whole world, underneath the airport. There's 5,000 nuclear weapons, and nobody talks about it. And it's bizarre to see, you know, especially, you know, people who work at Sandia or Los Alamos. I mean, these are caring, intelligent, decent people, and they go to work every day making weapons of mass destruction. There's something bizarre about the psyche of New Mexico. So, but there's lots of good action around the police issue.
Question I wanted to ask you.
Hang on just a sec. She's just going to see, and she hasn't had a chance to talk yet.
So I'm Marie Guillory. I'm married to Joe Cooney, and I'm an observer. And I can't help but make this observation as I listen to all of you speak. And my observation is this. I look for common threads, and also I'm listening to your past and your hopes, right? Your hopes for the future, and some frustration about whether or not what you did was of value and whether or not you carried it forward in your lives. So the principle that I think your involvement acknowledged and recognized and held up was really the basic principle of the Constitution and the Declaration, that all men are created equal, right? And what you were working for 50 years ago was this noble idea of equality, which is so American. It's not yet achieved, but it's a leveling process, right, that occurred because of your involvement and the involvement of many others. Even as you are still doing nursing, you're caring for people to bring them into health, and you as a doctor, you as a minister, you as a teacher. Everybody's working for this leveling, this dignity, to uphold people, to enjoy the dignity that's part of our our bequest, right? The dignity of man. So you know, looking for the future and what you're doing in the future, and you, the great movement, right? What is that great movement? Well, what's the future movement that will advance this cause of leveling? Actually, the Pope called it the common good.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's really what he called it, the common good. So I just had to share that reflection with you, because when I listen to groups like this, I try to figure out what's going on, what are the threads that unite you, and what are your hopes? So.
Thank you.
I just want to ask you, last week I just got my marching orders from the UAW Civil Rights of Detroit. We're pushing for voter education, voter registration, and that's the area that we're supposed to. Are you working with Civil Rights Division in Detroit? Well, that's my boss. And what we're putting out paper right now, educating people about voting and how to vote, what they need to go to the voting place. There's a lot of places, what papers they need to vote with. And I find that very, very important. I'm getting my teeth full. I didn't mean to be here today, but well, you probably got the order too. It's very, very important what we do in voting rights. We're dealing with young people. And what I'm doing right now, going back to school, to UCLA, and get all the people that we can to come out and work with, like we did with Chavez and Grayton. We're doing the same thing now. We're going to educate people, young people, how to vote, what they need to vote, and not tell them who to vote for, but to vote. And we find that a lot of young people, 17 soon turning, know nothing about voting. 18, 19, 20, they don't vote. The largest voting group we had was when Obama ran in 2008. The other big group we had, I think, was in 68, when we were trying to seat the Freedom Party out of Mississippi. But we had the riots in Detroit and that mess that up. I mean, Chicago. But voting right now is very, very important. And that's, you know, when I go home and I got to finish the dentist and everything, I'm going right back out to California and put our stuff together for voting. It's very important. And the next election, we got two Supreme Court justices are going to be elected.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's important.
Yeah. And you better have a say-so.
I've got to say, this is Peggy Ryan Fooligan, at 89, you're inspirational. So I hope I can be half as active and engaged as you are. I think per the schedule, we're about done. So I don't know if people want to continue or...
I just wanted to... Leverett Millen, I wanted to make one observation. The... AFSCME and the Teachers Union, they had a 37% of their people voted. And so it's really a very important issue. But what we're trying to do is get union members to start talking to other union members about progressive legislation, which we have the Health Security Act in New Mexico, and to get them to honor and develop the union as a place where lots of good things go on and real democracy is taking place. So we're trying to energize the grassroots of the union as well as get out the voting. But voting is critical. I mean, the teachers union is 37%, and we have a right-wing governor who wants to destroy public education. So, hello.
Who's learning from ours?
But it's about the, you know, re-energizing the labor movement and have it be in the leadership of social justice.
But you know, we're pushing.
Yeah.
We're pushing now, and we just got $300,000 going.
This is Jim Brown talking.
Go ahead. Told you.
Yeah, okay, Jim. Oh, I'm sorry. Jim Brown. It's going to go into a mailer. What we're educating people this time, we want absentee ballots. We want people to vote absentee ballots. We find we'll get more people voting absentee ballots. We're teaching absentee ballots. So we're printing, we're just about every state that we can use them in. In some states that I'm being Spanish, whatever nationality or language they speak, you know, that's what we're doing. But it's going to be very, very important, the absentee ballots.
So we're back to voting again.
Yeah. Can't get away from it.
One of the problems that we all have is that we're beholden to what we believe. And what we believe is what we've experienced in the past.
You did?
It's difficult. It's going to be as difficult to change people's opinions about the history of the United States. Okay? It's going to be as difficult as if the Pope would come out tomorrow and say that there's historical evidence that Jesus Christ, you know, didn't exist. I see Christ as the first nonviolent peace activist that we know of, certainly in the Western world. I don't see him as God. I'm a pantheist. God is everything. If you've got to have a God, it's everything. But we have to look at that. Be willing to change if we get new information. Dr. King didn't finish his thing. There's a whole wide world of stuff that I think that he would have gotten into. The religions have been responsible for genocide, you know, for thousands of years. But that's no reason. I still work with anybody who wants to.
Excuse me.
I want to say one thing. I'm not supposed to say, but we're pushing for our registration.
Because Barbara Emerson wants to lead a memorial circle in about 20 minutes, we need to reconvene to do our report backs, and any unleft said things can be said either at that time or right after that time. But you need to wrap up your group like in 1 minute.
Okay.
Because
thank you, Maria.
All the other groups are done.
Okay, yeah. Jim, you get the last word here.
We're registering as women. Senior citizen. Women. That's who we're registered as. And the easiest to register, young women in school, men are the problem, so our push is for women.
I'll agree with that men are the problem.
Could I have a consensus here?
Is
anything that I said made any sense?
Yes.
Is it conceivable that something like this could happen?